I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Pope Francis spoke at the White House yesterday, the start of a whirlwind visit to the United States that concludes with a weekend here in Philadelphia. He spoke about his concern for the health of the environment, the future of the planet, and the unequal impact its destruction has had on the poor.
It seems clear to me also that climate change is a problem we can no longer be left to a future generation. When it comes to the care of our common home, we are living at a critical moment of history. We still have time to make the change needed to bring about a sustainable and integral development, for we know that things can change.
This has been a theme of Francis's papacy, and the message of his encyclical on climate change and inequality released earlier this year. It's an extraordinary document that calls on the world to stop the exploitation of the environment for profit and consumerism, something he reiterated this morning when he spoke to a joint session of Congress. We asked Naomi Oreskes to join us. She's an affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. She wrote the introduction to the new print edition of Pope Francis's encyclical on care of our common home. She's also the co-author with Eric Conway of a book called Merchants of Doubt. And Naomi Oreskes, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
You compare Pope Francis's encyclical in your introduction to this book to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, to Uncle Tom's Cabin. What are you saying here?
Well, books have the potential to change the world. I should add, my primary appointment is a professor of history of science at Harvard University. So I study the history of ideas and the history of how ideas can change the world. And we know that they can. And sometimes they express themselves and reach people through the medium of books. So the fact that the Pope issued an encyclical, which is a kind of small book, and it's been published now as a book, invited that comparison.
Because it's the Pope who's delivering this message, or is it the message itself?
Well, I think the comparison to Silent Spring and Uncle Tom's Cabin is about the message itself. Harriet Beecher Stowe was a known abolitionist, but she wasn't a world-famous figure before she wrote that book. What made that book powerful, and the same with Silent Spring, was the message in it. In this case, however, we have both. We have both a tremendously powerful message and a tremendously messenger. And so that combination really raises the possibility that this could be a transformative moment.
What's so interesting to me is that the Pope really is making this connection between climate change and income inequality. He really is linking these two important issues.
Exactly. And scientists, natural scientists and social scientists have said this before. Scientists have been saying for a long time that one of the reasons why climate change is a moral issue as well as an environmental and economic one is because the impacts are distributed unequally, that the people who are suffering the most are in general not the people who cause the problem. So there's a question of basic justice there, and that the poor are the most vulnerable. So this is something scientists have said before, but now it is the Pope, one of the world's leading moral authorities, who is saying it.
Right. He studied as a chemist. Is he a scientist?
No, the Pope's not a scientist, and he doesn't claim to be on television or otherwise, but he has spent a lot of time with scientists. I was privileged to be part of a meeting that took place at the Vatican a little over a year ago, in which about 50 natural and social scientists gathered to make presentations about climate change, both from the physical science side, what the evidence was, but also from the social science side in terms of why climate change impacts people and its adverse impacts, particularly on the poor and the vulnerable around the world. And that was a message that the Pope was very interested in. He didn't actually attend our sessions, but several of his key advisors did. And several of the leaders of this meeting did meet with him privately and have spoken to him at great length about the science. And it's clear that the Pope understands both the technical science, but also the social and political and moral ramifications.
And this is the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. Who's a member of this? Is this the kind of thing that they do, which is to advise whoever the Pope is on certain scientific issues?
Yes, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences is just what it says. It's an academy of science, and just as nations around the world, including the United States, have academies of science, so does the Vatican. And they have addressed many important and different issues, including things like human trafficking and public health. And in recent years, they've brought their attention, their focus to the question of climate change and its relationship to the social inequality.
Do you have to be a Catholic to be a member of this academy?
No, you don't, although I think you might have to be a Catholic to be the president of it, but I'm not sure. I don't think that's official, but that would seem to be, that's the impression one gets. But no, and I'm not Catholic, and I and quite a few other non-Catholics were invited to this meeting that I discussed last year.
So what is the message of the Pope about the climate, if it's possible to distill it down?
I think the key message is that the problem of climate change and the problem of inequality, most people think of as two separate, distinct, and even in some cases dichotomous problems. Some people will say, well, yes, the environment matters, but the poor matter more. And what the Pope has done, which I think is so significant, is to say these are not two separate problems. These are two sides of the same coin. And the reason he says that is twofold. One, he's saying that exploitation of the environment and exploitation of people are part and parcel of the same attitude. It's an attitude of disrespect for God's creation. God made this planet, God made all the plants and animals on it, and God made us. And when we disrespect or exploit any part of that, we are doing violence to God's work. And that's a very powerful religious message for any believer, Catholic or non-Catholic. But then he also has a message that's more secular, which is really about capitalism.
Right.
And in some ways, this is the greatest challenge that this document poses, not just to conservatives, but to liberals as well, since plenty of liberals are advocates of market mechanisms to solve problems. So what he's really saying is that if we look at the last 30 years of deregulated capitalism, what we see is that despite all the promises that the rising tide would raise all ships, the reality is that about 2 billion people have been left out in the cold, and that the basic problems of the poorest people on Earth have not been addressed by the last 30 or 40 years of global prosperity. And meanwhile, we have done this profound, profound environmental damage that actually now threatens the future prosperity of all of us. So deregulated capitalism is actually threatening the prosperity that it's meant to generate.
And that's something I do want to pick up with our second guest. We'll be talking more about the Pope's message about consumerism and economies. He uses some really interesting language here. The earth, our home, he uses the word home a lot, which of course is a very powerful word, is beginning to look more like an immense pile of filth. And I just had to sort of underscore that word, that's pile of filth. Very powerful language he uses here.
Yes, when I read that, my first reaction was, oh no, that's all anyone is going to quote in this thing.
Of course.
So
it sort of jumps out at you, but
it
still.
It does. But I think also, I think it shows that actually the Pope did receive the message of our meeting, because one of the very evocative presentations at the meeting was a meeting by a social scientist about the growth of mega cities. And she had very disturbing and really heartbreaking photographs of garbage pickers in cities like Sao Paulo. And Sao Paulo, actually, when you see these pictures, large parts of it are an immense pile of filth. So I think that the Pope is not just using that phrase metaphorically. I think he's actually talking about literally the piles of filth in megacities like Sao Paulo, the piles of filth, the plastic that's now accumulating in the Pacific Ocean, and many other areas of really devastating environmental destruction that most of us on a daily basis just turn a blind eye to.
Some have used the scripture to talk about, you know, dominion over nature, over animals. How does the Pope address that issue?
The Pope takes that one on head on. And if any religious—
That's a leading question there, but no, go
yes,
ahead, please.
That's okay. I invite leading questions. The Pope, I really hope that any religious believer, if they read no other part of the encyclical, they read this section, because the Pope adamantly rejects any interpretation that says that Christianity sanctions the destruction of the environment. And he says that is a misinterpretation of Scripture. And he acknowledges that it has been at times a common misinterpretation, that people have misinterpreted the idea of dominion as implying that we have the right to do whatever we want to do. He says that's wrong, it's false, that we are the keepers of the earth. But to keep is both to use for productive purposes, but also to preserve and protect and to hand down to future generations. So it's really a kind of notion of a trust that God has given us. He's trusted us. He's given us a trust to benefit from this amazing creation, this amazing planet, this amazing bounty that we have, but not to destroy it and not to use it in a way that leaves it diminished for future generations.
Is there a word that the Pope uses or that we can use when we talk about the Pope's view on the environment that covers his perspective on this?
Well, I like the word keeping because I think, you know, we think about when we marry, we promise to keep and treasure. But certainly the word stewardship is one that many people have invoked. I feel like stewardship seems a bit utilitarian, frankly. So I like the idea of keeping because it feels like it invokes a notion of love, which is really at the root of all of the Pope's message and arguably at the root of the message of all religious faith.
Does he assign blame in this? Blame, I mean, you mentioned the sort of unbridled capitalism and perhaps the sort of use of the earth for our own immediate needs. But does he assign blame for the climate catastrophe or problem that we're in today?
Well, you know, blame is a tricky word. I think that the Pope is a man who truly works from love. I think he is a true Christian in that way. So I think that he probably wouldn't want to really use the word blame. And I can't offhand actually remember the word blame in the encyclical. Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess that it's actually not there. I think he does think in terms of things like responsibility. And certainly he is very clear that some of us have much more responsibility for this problem than others.
Well, he seems also, I don't think blame is exactly the right word, but he talks about the spiritual impoverishment of the wealthy and the people that consume don't necessarily enjoy the happiness that might come with consumption.
Exactly. And I think that's another powerful part of the message, which I actually emphasized in my introduction. In a way, it shows that the Pope is not blaming us. He's actually trying to help us because he says, look, we have this system that some people, about 2 billion people on Earth, have benefited from very, very well. And we're very prosperous and we have, you know, riches of all different kinds, good health care, good food. We get to travel. We live in warm, safe, well-lit houses. But then he says, but, you know, even the people who benefit from the system, are they really happy?
Hmm.
And that's where he brings in this idea of the spiritual impoverishment and that he says we've replaced meaning with activity. So we're all very busy. We're all incredibly busy all the time. And now that we have devices, we're even busier than we used to be. And everyone is incredibly busy. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed this in your own life,
absolutely,
right? You can't even get a dentist appointment, right?
Exactly.
And how did that happen? We weren't all this busy 30 years ago. So some of it has to do with the idea that all this activity hasn't necessarily made our lives truly better in the meaningful and important ways.
Well, let me pick up on that. That's Naomi Oreskes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we're talking about Pope Francis and his views on climate change. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Pope Francis, as you know, has been outspoken on the issue of global warming and climate change, releasing an encyclical earlier this year on the environment called On the Care of Our Common Home. He is urging scientists and religious leaders to work together on this issue. Our guest, Naomi Oreskes, is a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. She wrote the introduction to the new print edition of Pope Francis's encyclical On the Care of Our Common Home, also co-author with Eric Conway of a book called Merchants of Doubt. And to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I should say in about 20 minutes or so, we'll be talking with our second guest on what the Pope says about finance and money and economies. Naomi, an interesting email from Julia. I was thinking about this as well. Please have your speaker address the issue of population control and climate change as it pertains to Catholic doctrine against birth control. And this, of course, is when things can get complicated. Does the Pope look at the issue, perhaps potential problem of population explosion?
Many people have raised this question, and any Catholic who is hoping that the Pope would use climate change as an opportunity to change the Church's position on birth control and abortion will be disappointed. So there's no sign that there's any change in Church doctrine on that issue. But the Pope does something that I think is very important and that I agree with 100%, which is that he points out that to blame this problem on population in many ways is a misdiagnosis of the problem, because disruptive climate change and environmental destruction in general is not primarily a problem of population per se. It's primarily a problem of consumption. So just to give one example, sure, there's been lots of attention paid in recent years to the fact that Chinese emissions have grown very dramatically. But the reality is that there's more than three times as many people in China as there are in the United States. So even though Chinese emissions are about the same as American emissions now, the average American is still responsible for more than three times as much greenhouse gas pollution as the average Chinese person. So even though China has this giant population, you know, the average American is really much more responsible for climate change than the average Chinese person. And if we look at Pakistanis or people in Bangladesh, then it's about 10 Bangladeshis. So the places in the world where we are driving climate change are not the places that have very high rates of population growth. And I think that's a really important thing for all of us to take on board, because if we shift the attention to population, we're really shifting attention to the places that are not primarily responsible for this problem. Now, that's not to say that population is not an issue in other ways. And I do think that the Pope could do more to address some of the ways in which population is a factor in driving other forms of environmental destruction, but it's not the primary driver. And he's really asking us to focus attention on the role of consumption and a certain kind of very, very high consumptive lifestyle, which is behind this. He also makes one other really important point, that a lot of the environmental destruction in what we could call the global south and less developed countries is done producing goods and services for export markets, primarily to the United States and Europe. So again, whose responsibility is that? You know, is that the maquiladoras in Mexico, or is it those of us north of the border who are buying those products and using them and throwing them away?
Is he asking Americans to live more simply?
Well, I think that's the implicit message for sure, because his own model of living simply, right. I mean, I think, you know, he's speaking through his actions there. So I think he is encouraging us to think about ways that a simpler, less consumptive life could be less destructive, and in some ways it could also be happier and more meaningful.
Is the Pope also in this encyclical telling people specifically and almost concretely what they can do to help the planet either heal or to prevent the further destruction, erosion of the planet?
Well, that's a good question. I think people will have different interpretations of that. There are certainly places in the encyclical where he makes some concrete suggestions, like being home for dinner on Friday night, you know, having dinner with your family, saying a blessing before eating. So not just rushing into eating, but stopping for a moment to appreciate the grace of food. He talks about gardening, which is something that I related to, because I've recently taken up gardening and I highly recommend it to
all
people.
It's a great thing, isn't it?
It's a very great thing on so many levels.
Yes.
And I've planted a pollinator-friendly garden, and it's such a joy to see the bumblebees and the butterflies and how quickly they come when you plant. You know, the reward is very quick, which is good for an academic who's used to delayed gratification. You know, so he does have a few specific things. But I think one of the things that's beautiful about the document is he's not exactly telling us what to do in terms of specifics. It's not a checklist. It's not, here's 10 things you can do to stop climate change. He's asking us to stop and think. And I think each of us in our own ways, if we read the encyclical and take it to heart, we will see what aspects of our own life we might want to begin to change, whether it's in terms of our political views, our day-to-day life, gardening, eating with our families, whatever it is. There are so many. I mean, the good thing about this problem is there are so many different ways in which we can make a difference, and every single person has the opportunity to begin today to do something that could make a difference.
we've done shows probably with you and certainly with other people as well about concerns about climate change. And there are always calls about, you know, what can I do? What, as an individual, what can I do? But when you look at the kind of seriousness of things like sea level rise and what we're observing with the poles, one wonders whether taking the time to have dinner together will be enough to address what's already seems baked into the system.
Well, you're absolutely right. No one thing is enough, and a certain amount of change is baked in. There is what scientists call the climate commitment. My teenage daughters years ago said to me, Mom, only men think commitment is a bad thing. So, you know, we should probably call it the climate sentence, right? The bad news of this story is that we are locked into probably at least 2 degrees centigrade of climate change, and that some of these changes we're already seeing with droughts, with floods, with intensification of storms, with the intensification of wildfires in the West. Some of this is here to stay, and that's the bad news of this story. The only good news is that it's not too late to stop the worst damage, and that the Pope has a vision of how we can do it in a way that includes all people on the planet and makes the world better for all of us. And again, I think that's really the power and the beauty of this document.
Well, and he's really focusing on the impact of sea level rise, which tends to be on, globally speaking, on people who are impoverished or living pretty marginal lives.
Exactly. And I mean, Bangladesh is sort of the poster child for climate change. And that's a really good example of here you have a population with literally hundreds of millions of people completely innocent in terms of the creation of this problem. Most Bangladeshis use virtually no fossil fuels compared to an American or a European. And yet they are at the front line of sea level rise and will be greatly, greatly impacted by a problem that they did almost nothing to contribute to.
That's Naomi Oreskes. And again, she's at Harvard University and wrote the introduction to this new print edition of Pope Francis's encyclical on care of our common home, and wrote a book with Eric Conway called Merchants of Doubt. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Essentially, what is Francis saying about our climate, about climate change, and about the planet as well? You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadiotimes. Naomi, I have a transcript of what the Pope said this morning to a joint session of Congress. I'll just quote a couple of sentences here. He says, "I call for a courageous and responsible effort to redirect our steps and to avert the most serious effects of the environmental deterioration caused by human activity. I'm convinced that we can make a difference, and I have no doubt that the United States and this Congress have an important role to play." I would have liked to have been in that room to see how that message was received. Do you share the Pope's confidence about our Congress?
Well, confidence is not a word that I think most people would use today in relation to the U.S. Congress on any level. So this is a moment of hope. This is a moment of aspiration, and it's a moment of opportunity. I think what the Pope is doing is giving people an opportunity. He's giving them the opportunity to say, it's not too late. Whatever you've done in the past, whatever mistakes you may have made, whatever beliefs you held that perhaps were not necessarily supported by the science, it's not too late. And after all, I mean, what is the message of Christianity if not a message of forgiveness? So he's saying, just because you haven't done the right thing up until now, it's not too late to do it now. And of course, you know, you asked about what people can do.
Sure.
It's not a coincidence. He's at Congress. The United States Congress has been a very, very major obstacle to action on climate change, in part through tremendous and staggering, shocking denial, outright denial of the fact that this is a real problem. And that, of course, was the topic of my book with Eric Conway, Merchants of Doubt. And so now you have people in Congress who have been participating in either active or passive denial for a long time. And the Pope is giving them an opportunity to change that and to do something new. And in effect, I see it as he's giving them, in a way, an opportunity to save face. Mm. I think that people could say, we didn't really appreciate it until now. Maybe we didn't fully understand it. The Holy Father has really explained it in a way that now is clear to us. And it gives us an opportunity to have a new conversation about what this really means and why it affects all of us. And if I could just add one other thing,
please.
You know, on the sea level rise question, it's important to talk about Bangladesh because it's important to talk about the vulnerability of the innocent, because in a way that's what responsibility and accountability is all about. And of course, accountability is a conservative and traditional Republican value. But we shouldn't think that we're off scot-free either, because sea level rise, as people in the northeast of the United States know, it's already affecting New York and Philadelphia, and it's affecting Florida and the Texas Gulf Coast, and it will affect California and the West Coast as well. So all of us will be affected, and no one should think that this is only a problem of the poor. But at the same time, it is really important, as the Pope says, for us to realize that there's a basic question of justice here, as well as a question of self-preservation.
Well, this is America, so let me quote something that Rush Limbaugh said about this encyclical. This, I guess, was when it first came out. He said, essentially, what this papal encyclical is saying is that every Catholic should vote for the Democratic Party. How else do you interpret it when the Pope comes out and sounds like Al Gore on global warming and climate change? Do you think the Pope is close to Al Gore on this particular issue?
No, I don't, actually. I think his perspective is actually different in certain key ways, although Al Gore is a Christian, too. So maybe in some ways it's not surprising. Well, look, I could say two things to that. On the one hand, I could say for the first time in my life, I agree with Rush Limbaugh and all these people should now vote for the Democrats. But I actually don't think that's the message. And I think that Mr. Limbaugh actually has misunderstood this, as he misunderstands most things. It's really a call for Republicans to step up to the plate, to embrace traditional conservative values of responsibility, of accountability, of liberty and justice for all, not just for corporate America. Many, many values. The Pope began his speech with saying that he was proud to be in the land of the free and the home of the brave. It's a call to be brave. It's a call to stand up against the cowardice, really, of the last 30 years and to say, we will be brave. It's a Republican value to be brave, to be courageous, and to take on a serious problem. It's an American value. So I don't think it's so much a call for Republicans to become Democrats as it's a call for Republicans and Democrats together alike, and conservatives, liberals, independents, everyone, to step up to the plate and work together and fix this problem.
I do want to get to some callers, but I'm curious about, because some have said there could be some technological fixes. You know, we could do things to turn back the rising seas or even the increase in climate temperatures. Does the Pope see technology as a fix? I know he talks about blind confidence in technical solutions, but does he also see technology as a potential fix to some of the problems we've created?
Technology obviously is going to be part of the answer to this question, because we all need energy. No one denies that we need energy. Nobody wants to live in a world without energy. Not the rich, not the poor, not Americans, not Bangladeshis. And the Pope is very mindful of that. So the encyclical, the speech, is not a rejection of technology per se. But it is a rejection of what I call techno-fideism, that is to say, a kind of blind faith in technology and a faith in a kind of god of technology, that there'll be a magic, some kind of magic of the mark, that there'll be some kind of magical technology that will somehow solve our problems and we don't have to do anything. We can just sit here waiting for it to arrive. That's the indictment. It's the indictment of the mentality of techno-fideism, not the indictment of technology itself. It's also an indictment of a certain kind of market ideology, what he says calls the faith in the deified market, or what I call, you know, the faith in the magic of the marketplace. I mean, it's always been amazing to me that grown people talk about the magic of the marketplace, since magical thinking is supposed to be characteristic of young children who don't understand reality, right? So we've had 30 years for the markets to respond to this problem. Scientists have been talking about this since the 1960s. Scientists have been talking about this issue and talking about it really seriously since the late 1980s. So the markets have had lots of time to respond, but we don't have the technologies we need at the scale we need. The technologies exist, but they haven't been implemented on the scale they need. And there's a lot of reasons why that's the case. But what the Pope is saying is that to get those technologies on the scale we need and to share them around the globe equitably with all of the people who need them, we have to take that up as a challenge. And we can't just sit on our hands and say, oh, it will happen on its own accord, because it hasn't happened on its own accord for the last 50 years.
Let me get a caller in before we have to say goodbye to you. We have Neil from Glen Olden. And Neil, go ahead. We're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hey, Marty. I'm not trying to be super sensitive, but does he preach this same message in China, in India, in Europe? I've been to Scotland. They deregulated the bus industry, and these double-decker buses had 5-inch exhaust pipes pumping blue exhaust. I couldn't even leave the hotel after 5 o'clock at night.
Neil, I'm not sure what you're trying to say.
I get the question. The question is he bringing this message to everyone around the world? And the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, the encyclical has already been published in, I think it's something like 30 languages. The Pope has already started traveling around the globe, and I know he intends to travel more. So the short answer is absolutely yes. This is a message for all people in all corners of the earth. There is no question about that. And one of the reasons why it's such a powerful message is because the Pope has a reach. The Pope is listened to in so many different places on earth.
Neil, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Naomi, thank you for understanding the question and jumping in there.
Not a problem. I'm a professor. I have to understand all kinds of different questions.
No, I should as well. But about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. And this is just, you know, the Pope's been in the country, 24 hours? Are you surprised at just the outpouring of enthusiasm and support and attention and love for this Pope?
Well, I'm not surprised because having met him, albeit briefly, he is a special man. You can just be in his presence and you feel the aura, the radiance. I mean, he is a graced person. But I think that it also shows that people are ready to hear the message, that we all know in our hearts that something isn't right, but we don't know how to fix it. And I think the Pope is giving us an opportunity to have a conversation about that that I think many, many people welcome.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, she's a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. And again, she wrote the introduction to the new print edition of Pope Francis's encyclical on the care of our common home. And as we mentioned before, she's also co-author with Eric Conway of a book called Merchants of Doubt. We're going to take a very short break, and then we have a second guest joining us. We'll be talking a bit about what the Pope has been saying about money and capitalism and finance and economies. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Pope Francis has had some choice words about capitalism, describing its excesses as dung of the devil. He calls financial greed a subtle dictatorship that enslaves men and women. Just how radical are these ideas? Nathan Schneider has been writing about the Pope's views on the global economy. He's a reporter and professor of media studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's a regular columnist for America Magazine, that's a national Catholic weekly published by the Jesuit Order, and he's written two books on politics and religion. And Nathan Schneider, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me give out the phone number to our listeners. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Nathan, I just said goodbye to Naomi Oreskes, and we were talking about the Pope's encyclical. And what's so interesting is this connection that he made about climate change and the economy and our consumptive world. Can you address some of the connection that you see there?
Well, absolutely. It's a really important connection, and it's one that I think the environmental movement in the U.S. has been kind of slow to make in some ways, I think, because it's kept itself very kind of white and elite, and it's insulated itself from the fact that that the people who are most affected, who are already experiencing the climate crisis right now, are those most vulnerable in our world. And Francis brings those together, and he doesn't just say these are connected, but that they're integrally related, and that you can't talk about the environment without talking about how we treat each other as human beings and vice versa.
Is the Pope a Marxist?
Oh, I think it's a very strange label to put on somebody who spent much of his career in Argentina kind of stuck in the middle of the Cold War. You know, we're used to putting people in capitalist or Marxist boxes in the U.S. That's a Cold War mentality that really has to go. And this is a person who's bringing a breath of fresh air. He spent his life trying to recognize the truth in enterprise, in business. This morning he told Congress business is a vocation. But on the other hand, he's been somebody who's honored the Marxist attention on the poor, while at the same time being willing to criticize the excesses of both, and trying to highlight the fact that we can think in other ways. We don't have to work through those Cold War categories.
Is there a word to describe his economic or financial ideology or beliefs?
Well, there are a couple of ways of approaching it. You know, it's not something one can easily systematize because he's trying to summarize centuries and centuries of Catholic social teaching. One part of it is this concept of personalism. This is the idea that we've got to center the economy on people, on human beings. Another concept, something that he mentioned at least twice in his address to Congress this morning, is subsidiarity. And this is the idea that people should govern what affects them, that institutions and enterprises shouldn't be governed by investors, perhaps, or profiteers who are remote from them and who aren't really affected but are just extracting profits. They should be governed by the people who are most impacted, who are the true stakeholders and the true beneficiaries or victims of an enterprise.
Which makes you wonder what he would think about Wall Street or the way, you know, in many ways we do business and we do finance in this country.
Yeah, and he's spoken about that. You know, in the recent encyclical, he talked about the unlearned lessons of the financial crisis. And again, I think he's trying to call us to think about economics in a different way, a way that includes enterprise and creativity and entrepreneurship, but also includes a kind of social vision. And one thing that he's mentioned again and again in that encyclical and in other places as well is the tradition of cooperative economics, you know, a kind of business that, you know, goes back centuries to the monastic traditions, but also in the modern world has a real kind of strong secular basis. A kind of enterprise in which workers govern the businesses where they work, where you know, a food co-op, where customers join together in order to get healthy food at affordable prices. This is the kind of thing he points to when he talks about, for instance, how to transition the energy system and how to change our relationship with technology. He also really points to the voices of social movements, of grassroots movements among poor people, and has repeatedly said, you are where change must come from, and you are our inspiration right now.
Do his ideas and what he says, is that a big departure from previous popes, or is he just more outspoken, or perhaps people are more willing to listen to this pope?
It's hard to put your finger on it, really. You know, if you compare his statements on the economy to those of his immediate predecessor, Benedict XVI, they're very, very similar. A lot of the same language, a lot of the same concerns. Again, a concern that capitalism is turning our attention away from human needs. During Benedict's period, he was referred to as the Green Pope. So he was bringing up environmental issues as well. But I think it really matters that this Pope Francis is coming from the global south. He's coming from direct personal experience with people who are really on the front lines of the suffering that the global economic order is inflicting. And he's seen these things. He's experienced these things. And he's speaking with a conviction of that experience. It's not an abstraction.
And you're talking about his growing up, his living in Argentina. At one point in Argentina's life, I think it was 2001, there was a serious economic crisis, which had a huge impact on that country and the people living in that country.
Yeah, and he's a person who, grew up in a kind of modest means, but really over the course of his life made a commitment to not just talking about the poor and theorizing about the poor, but really being a presence among the poor. In his biographies, you see him making a commitment to himself to visit the slums every week, even when he was the archbishop. And this really manifested itself in that the upper classes and Buenos Aires society didn't feel like they really knew their archbishop, and they were always kind of surprised as he would continue to ascend the ranks. But the poor knew him very, very well because he was He was a presence among them. He would go to poor neighborhoods and listen to confessions, just to hear what people were really struggling with. And I think, when I imagine who is his intended audience, who is he thinking of when he's formulating what he's saying to the great powers of the world right now, I sometimes think, maybe he's imagining the person in the slum and the confessional there.
Huh. Is he asking us to do the same?
I think absolutely. And we see this in the way in which over the course of this trip, he's making sure to spend time among the poor. And this isn't just a kind of symbolic action. This is a call to listen, to pay attention, to recognize, again, that personalism, to recognize others as people. When he spoke before Congress today, he didn't say, do this or do that in terms of your immigration policy. He said, recognize these people as people. Hear their stories. Don't create policies in abstraction separate from those stories, but build your policymaking around those stories and the recognition of these people as human beings.
An emailer says, please have your speaker address the fact that the Pope is a follower of Perón's doctrine of a third position between capitalism and communism. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, he was a great admirer of the Perón's in certain respects. One is certainly that that effort to try to cull the values and the benefits of both a kind of entrepreneurial capitalism and the social vision of the Marxist approach, and to kind of synthesize them into something different. Also, he takes, I think, a lot of the leadership style from Perón, this intensely personal leadership style that's centered around a person and can in some ways be kind of contradictory when he's always trying to point our attention to the margins. But also, there's something that he's drawing on here that wasn't perhaps so much on Perón's mind, which is 2,000 years of Catholic tradition. And, when he talks about the common good, when he talks about subsidiarity, the right of workers and human dignity, this is stuff that has a great deal of resonance and that has been talked about by popes, but also by millions and millions of Catholic lay people for centuries. So he's really just presenting this tradition and reminding us that we don't have to continue living in this bizarre Cold War framework, that our tools, our resources for thinking through our economic challenges are much more rich.
I've read two things about him and liberation theology, one that he's a supporter and one that he rejected it. Can you solve that dilemma for us?
Well, again, this is the delicate line that he's been walking his whole career. In Argentina, he was often critical of those who used liberation theology as an opportunity to replace their faith, replace that sense of the transcendent and the essential dignity of people with a secular political doctrine. And, I think from the Catholic point of view, that's a very valid critique. On the other hand, he was very supportive of those liberation theologians who truly went among the poor and tried to raise the voices of the oppressed. And we've seen this in his period as Pope. He's been reopening a conversation with liberation theology, legitimizing it, recognizing that this is a part of our tradition that we should honor. And, this morning when he talked about Dorothy Day before Congress, she wasn't formally a Latin American liberation theologian, but he was honoring that side of American history and Catholic tradition that emphasized the voices and the needs of the poor and that called for social change through those voices and through those needs.
In fact, I have his words in front of me. He said, in these times when social concerns are so important, I cannot fail to mention the servant of God, Dorothy Day, who founded the Catholic Worker Movement. Her social activism, her passion for justice and for the cause of the oppressed were inspired by the gospel, her faith, and the example of saints. Just underscoring what he said this morning. I mean, in many ways, and this is a more economic question, I mean, what does he think about things like trickle down, which has been certainly a economic political philosophy in this country? Would he reject something like that?
Well, that's a case of something that he's explicitly called out, where he's by name denounced those who put their faith, and that this is really what he's concerned about, is the idolatry. Those who put their faith in the idea that that enriching the wealthy will then end up solving the problems of the poor. From his experience in Argentina, that simply is not borne out by facts, and also it is rooted in this. In this worship of wealth as something that solves our problems for us. Instead, he's trying to call us to a kind of economics that, again, is centered on people. And cooperativism has that kind of built into its logic that the economy is there for the people who depend on it and who need it, that it's not something where people are just grabbing the crumbs from the master's table that happen to fall off.
Would you say, I mean, asking you to speak for the Pope, which I realize is completely unfair, but you're about as close as I'm going to get. How would he, or how does he view the American dream as we, you know, probably mostly fantasize about it, but it, you know, it certainly has existed over time.
You know, it's an interesting question because he talked about dreams a couple of times and kind of at the beginning and at the end of his speech. So he really made that a major theme. And I think part of that is he's trying to underscore the immigrant experience and underscore the values that we at least claim to hold in this country about being a place for all, a place of opportunity, a place of freedom. He wants to affirm those. And in particular, I think he wants to call attention to the crisis of migration, of refugees. You know, he talks about immigration in a way that is so different from the way that we're used to hearing it talked about in the U.S. Congress. You know, where we hear it talked about from a very kind of nativist American perspective. Who are these people coming, invading our land? He is talking kind of from a global perspective. He's saying these are people who are, you know, in dire situations, in part because of policies that are coming from the U.S., and we have to hear their stories out. We have to hear also the fact that they're coming with dreams, just like his parents came to Argentina with dreams from Europe, just like many of our ancestors came to the United States, to this land, in pursuit of a dream, or at least in pursuit of an opportunity that they couldn't have elsewhere. And so he's trying to reframe a discussion that has been so divisive in our country.
We're almost out of time here, and an unfair question. I mean, do you think he can or will change policy in this country? Everyone loves the Pope today. What about next week when he's gone home?
Well, I think that what he's really asking for, and this again goes to that idea of subsidiarity, is not for us to wait around for him to change things. He's really calling on us to recognize our own power, to recognize, for instance, that we can govern our economy through cooperative economics, that we can make the decisions. We can come to solutions, to responses to the crises of climate and immigration. He's not telling us what those how to solve these problems. He's just trying to encourage us and remind us that we can, that power is ours, and that we should take advantage of it.
Nathan Schneider, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's a reporter, also professor of media studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's a regular columnist for America, and he's written two books on politics and religion. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Tell us what you think of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.